Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 269 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'll be talking about some orthopedic pathologies that are classically tested on the USMLE exams. Basically, I'm going to be making ortho podcasts, and they're going to have like specific themes, right? The theme for this one, I'm going to be talking about today are the bone tumors, right? So these bone tumors, they are things that just show up a lot on NBM exams, right? And again, for whatever reason, people tend to struggle with this stuff. So it's just one of these things you kind of want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. So what if they give you a question about a patient and, you know, they tell you that it's like a six-year-old girl, right? And they tell you that, or let's say six-year-old male, because this condition is actually a lot more common in males. And then they tell you that he has like this very severe pain in his lower femur, right? Or upper femur, right? And then they tell you that pain in upper femur worse at night, right? And then they tell you that, oh, it's better when he takes like Tylenol or something like that. If you see that, what should you be thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about an osteoid osteoma, right? So remember, an osteoid osteoma, classically, it gets better, it's worse at night, and it gets better when you consume NSAIDs, right? But one thing I want to say is, one thing your friends at the NBME love to conflate osteoid osteomas with is growing pains. And let me just tell you one very simple principle that will help you differentiate between those two. When people have an osteoid osteoma, it's going to be a unilateral process, right? When people have growing pains, it's going to be a bilateral process. It's going to be the same presentation on your exam. Bone pain that is worse at night gets better with NSAIDs. But if it's unilateral, it's going to be an osteoid osteoma. If it's bilateral, it's going to be growing pains, right? And the thing is, you may say, okay, Divine, why does the pain get worse at night in people that have osteoid osteomas? The reason behind that is you actually produce more prostaglandins at night, right? So the thing is, it's that prostaglandin production that ultimately leads to the pain, right? And the key critical thing you want to remember is, by giving an NSAID, which is a cyclooxygenase inhibitor, you will no longer produce those prostaglandins, and that will cut down on the child's pain, right? Now, one thing that your friends at the NBME love to do is they love to see if you are able to associate some buzzword descriptions with a particular bone pathology, right? So the thing is, you are not necessarily expected to be able to identify these pathologies on imaging. Even if they provide imaging, it's not going to be critical to answering your question correctly. But being able to look at the description they provide and say, oh, this is what they are going after, is actually a pretty useful rule with ortho, especially on NBME exams. The thing is, if they describe a bull's eye pattern on a radiograph, on a plain radiograph, then they are talking about an osteoid osteoma. Again, especially if you find it like in the femur or in the tibia, again, in the right patient population, which will be a kid, right? Because essentially the reason it's a bullseye is you basically see, if you look at this stuff on imaging, you basically see like a radiolucent like nidus in the middle, right? That's like the bullseye. And then you have like sclerotic bones surrounding it. So if you see that, that's the classic presentation of an osteoid osteoma. And then what if they give you a question about a child, right? And they tell you that this child has, you know, is just getting imaging for some other reason, like this is like an incidental finding, and they find the, on a plain radiograph, they see like this soap bubble-like lytic lesion on the child's femur, for example, and they say nothing in the question about the child having any symptoms or anything. This is just like an incidental finding, and they don't give you any other clues. What should you be thinking about? I would really hope that you're picking the answer that says that the child has something called a fibrous cortical defect. So fibrous cortical defects, they're actually usually symptomatic. They're usually found incidentally, right? And again, they have this soap bubble pattern on plain radiographs. And they tend to be, again, be found in the femur and the tibia. In fact, I'll tell you this. Most bone problems on NBME exams, especially in kids, show up in the tibia and in the femur. That's something that I think will help you quite significantly on NBMEs. Now, what if they give you a question about a child and they tell you that, you know, this child doesn't really have any symptoms, right? Doesn't really have any symptoms, doing pretty well. But again, as an incidental finding on imaging, they find like a mushroom-like defect on a plain radiograph of bone, of a bone, right? It can be like the femur, the tibia, the humerus, you find a mushroom-like defect. If you see this, what do you want to think about? I really hope that you're thinking about like an osteochondroma, okay? Think about an osteochondroma. The thing with osteochondromas is they look like mushrooms, right? So for people from not from the US, I mean, personally for me, I don't eat mushrooms. And I feel like most, at least where I come from, Nigeria, most people, I never saw anyone eat mushrooms ever in all my, what, like 18 years in Nigeria. So, but yeah, I now know what a mushroom is. Obviously, I haven't lived here for a while. But basically, right, if you see like a mushroom-shaped lesion on bone in a kid, especially a male kid, I want you to think about an osteochondroma. Maybe like, Divine, what's this mushroom coming from? It's actually pretty easy. The mushroom is actually basically like the head of the mushroom is like cartilage. That's why it's called osteochondroma, right? Chondro means cartilage, right? So it's called an osteochondroma because it's almost like you have a bone lesion that is capped by cartilage, right? So that's the big thing to keep in mind with that. Now, what if they give you a question about a child and they tell you that this child has like an asymptomatic, you know, again, just incidentaloma. They find it on incidentally on imaging. And this can be something that can show up in the hand or it can show up in the foot. So it tends to show up more in like smaller bones, right? And they tell you that they find this lytic lesion, right, has very sharp margins, but they tell you that it has a lot of like stippled calcifications or a lot of punctate calcifications or like pop, just basically imagine popcorn, right? Like a lot of popcorn-like calcifications, right? Like again, small bone, hand, foot, well circumscribed, popcorn-like calcifications, or they may use the word stippled or they may use the word punctate. If you see this, what do you want to think about? I would really hope that you're thinking about an enchondroma, right? An enchondroma. So again, let me summarize some of these findings I've described because again, it's just one of these things that are very high yield to know for exams. Osteoid osteomas, bullseye pattern, very high yield, right? So you find radiolucent center and then dense sclerotic bone around it. That's the bullseye. Just basically imagine like that bullseye rash of Lyme disease, but think of it in the bone. That's going to be an osteoid osteoma for you. A fibrous cortical defect is a soap-like lesion. It's a bubble-like lesion, right? And it'll have like a well-defined sclerotic margin, right? So it'll be like a soap. It'll be like soap bubbles, right? It'll be a lytic lesion. And then osteochondromas look like mushrooms. That's the big thing you want to keep in mind. The top of the mushroom, the head of the mushroom, is the cartilage that is capping that bone lesion. And then an enchondroma is going to be in small bones. It's going to be in the hand or in the foot. On an MBM exam, it's going to be well circumscribed and it's going to have a very specific distribution of calcifications. It'll be like, they may use the word stippled or punctate or popcorn-like calcifications. If you see that, then you absolutely want to think about an enchondroma. Now, one unfortunate thing that can happen with an enchondroma or an osteochondroma is that they can actually degenerate, right? So what if they give you a question and they tell you that, oh, this person that has either an enchondroma or an osteochondroma, they tell you that this child suddenly starts having like very, like they've known that the lesion existed in the past. And then the child starts having like very severe pain around the side of the initial lesion. If you see that, you absolutely, absolutely want to think about a chondrosarcoma, right? Chondrosarcomas, unfortunately, if they're low grade, you know, it's not a big deal. They're very treatable. But if they're high grade, that's bad, right? That's super, super bad, right? Like the survival rate is like 20 to 30, 40% or thereabouts. It's actually pretty, pretty bad lesion. And one thing, one clue, one telltale sign on an MBME that, oh, something like an enchondroma has progressed to becoming a chondrosarcoma is you don't have those lesions being well defined anymore. They're not going to be well circumscribed. They'll now be irregular. They'll be all over the place, right? Because remember, when things are metastasizing, they don't try to like, oh, let's go in a straight line. No. When malignancy is metastasizing, right? It loves to do it in a very bad way. You just go all over the place, right? So whenever you see like an irregular pattern of popcorn calcifications, right, in a child, right, you want to begin to think about things along the lines of like a chondrosarcoma. And then one thing that people always see on exams, because again, I think I've largely talked about like the benign bone lesions you may see on your test. As we begin to go into the more malignant ones, many people always wonder, like, Divine, where do these, I've heard of this term, Codman's triangle. On MBMEs, yes, that is specific for an osteosarcoma. But the thing is, Codman's triangle on an MBME can also just mean another kind of malignant bone lesion, right? So it's not something that you'll find that is absolutely specific to an osteosarcoma. Yes, usually it's going to go with an osteosarcoma, but it can also be something you would find in a person that has other malignant lesions. You can even find Codman's triangles in Ewing sarcoma, right? So again, always look at the whole context of an MBME question before you pick an answer. Don't pick an answer based on a small detail that you find in the question. That's usually not a strategy for success. So things that tell you that you're likely dealing with a malignant bone lesion on an MBME is the person will have Codman's triangles, right? They will have the sunburst pattern. They will have like an onion skin pattern to the periosteum. If you see any of those things, you want to be thinking about some kind of malignant bone lesion. And what's the pathophysiology behind a Codman's triangle? Really, the pathophys is essentially you have cancer that is standing between, that is basically lifting the cortex of the bone, like off of the surface of the bone, right? So it's almost like you have this cancer that's standing as a go-between between the bone and the cortex of the bone. So that causes the bone cortex, like the periosteum, to lift off, right? That's what's known as Codman's. That's what's known as Codman's triangle. So obviously, we cannot talk about malignant bone lesions without talking about osteosarcomas, right? Now, on MBME exams, osteosarcomas are very, very high yield to know, and they love to test risk factors. In fact, these things with risk factors, most likely sites of metastasis, those are things your friends at the MBME love to go after with osteosarcoma. Remember, osteosarcoma, a person can get that if they have a history of retinoblastoma in childhood, right? So they give you a question about a newborn that has a white reflex instead of a red reflex. That child has a retinoblastoma. That child having that red reflex, having that white reflex, right, has the RB gene mutation on retinoblastoma. That increases the child's risk of getting an osteosarcoma in the future. And then another thing that can also predispose a person to having osteosarcomas is if a person has a history of Paget's disease, right? Again, Paget's disease, when a person has Paget's disease, they have like disordered bone formation. The bone is very hypermetabolic. That can predispose the person to ultimately getting an osteosarcoma. Another thing that can predispose a person to getting an osteosarcoma on an MBME exam is if they are taking this drug known as teriparatide, right? So we know that teriparatide is a drug that's used to treat osteoporosis on MBMEs. And if you're wondering why, well, the thing is teriparatide is basically a PTH analog. And PTH kind of works like GnRH in a sense. If you give PTH in a continuous fashion, that's going to cause bone to be resorbed. But if you give PTH in a pulsatile fashion, that's actually going to cause bone to be built. So when people take teriparatide, so it's spelled as T-E-R-I-P-A-R-A-T-I-D-E, teriparatide. If people take teriparatide, you're essentially giving them a stimulating factor for a bone. So again, if you're giving something that causes like uncontrolled proliferation of bone, it should not be hard to imagine that that person could potentially get an osteosarcoma from that. This is why on MBME exams, you shouldn't give teriparatide for more than 2 years. If you give it for more than 2 years, I wish you all the best. Sounds like you want to give that patient osteosarcoma. Now, one other unusual thing you may see on an exam as a risk factor for osteosarcoma is if a person has had like radiation to an extremity, right? Having radiation to an extremity is actually a risk factor for the development of osteosarcoma of the bone that constitutes that extremity. And one thing the MBME likes to do, because it's one of these things, right? I get it from students all the time. They'll be like, oh, Divine, they didn't test the classic risk factor I'm used to. No. The thing is, on these exams, you also have to apply some wisdom, right? The thing is, if, for example, they give you a question about a person that has had radiation therapy to the bone, right? They've had radiation therapy to an extremity for some lesion in the past. And then they tell you that, oh, this person took teriparatide for like 2 weeks, like a few years ago. And then they say, which of the following represents the biggest risk factor for, let's say the person has osteosarcoma in the question. Which of the following represents the biggest risk factor for the development of osteosarcoma in this patient? Obviously, the answer is not going to be teriparatide. Even if teriparatide is a risk factor, the person was exposed to teriparatide for only 2 weeks. So there's no way that can be the thing that's causing the patient's osteosarcoma. So it's just one of those weird things you want to keep in mind, right? So they may give you multiple risk factors, but ask yourself, which one has the patient been exposed to the most? That will likely be the biggest risk factor for that condition with that patient. And osteosarcomas, whenever you're working up osteosarcomas, this is going to lead into another question that the MBM loves to test. You always have to do some kind of chest CT. You know why? Because the most common location of metastasis of osteosarcomas is actually the lungs. That's also the most common site of metastasis of choriocarcinomas. Choriocarcinomas, they love to go to the lungs. Again, one of those weird, bizarre things you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. So whenever you're working up an osteosarcoma, you always, always need to do a CT chest because you want to rule out mets to the lungs. And again, don't forget your classic imaging findings for osteosarcoma, right? Codman's triangle, sunburst pattern, right? Basically, the sunburst pattern you're seeing is just the tumor, the malignancy, essentially sneaking its way into the periosteum, going past the periosteum. That's what you see as the sunburst pattern around the person's bone. And in general, if a person has osteosarcoma, you know, you can do bone scans to try to figure out, again, the extent of the lesion, the extent of the metastasis. But one classic treatment for osteosarcomas that people fall into as a problem on exams is amputation. You almost never amputate the extremity of a person that has an osteosarcoma. Typically, what you would do is you would resect the lesion from within the bone. It's almost like you're scooping out the lesion, right? But you almost always try to salvage the limbs. It's just one of those weird things that you may say, no, I don't need to know that for an exam. And then you sit on an exam and then you start scratching your head. I don't want you scratching your head on an exam, right? So it's just one of these big things I think you should keep at the back of your mind. You always try limb salvage therapy. You're going to get out the lesion, but you don't need to amputate the person's extremity while you're at it. And then what if they give you a question about a child and they tell you that this child, for the last few weeks, this child has been having very high fevers, has a lot of swelling around his left femur, has a lot of erythema around his left femur, and they may even give you some labs. They may tell you that this child has a hemoglobin of 7, so this child is anemic. The white count is really high, let's say it's like 17,000, ESR, CRP, LDH, all elevated. You're like, man, does this child have an infection? Well, you notice that, man, this child has been having this thing for weeks. If you see stuff like this, you absolutely, absolutely want to think about an Ewing's sarcoma. You want to think about an Ewing's sarcoma. And Ewing sarcomas, one thing your friends at the MBME love to do is they will tell you that they biopsy the lesion and they saw small round blue cells. If you see stuff like that, again, you want to think about Ewing sarcoma. And don't forget, this is one of those things that you treat with actinomycin D, or sometimes we call that dactinomycin on an MBME exam. And it also has one of those fancy genetic translocations, right? It has the 1122 translocation. So you create like this fusion protein called like EWS-FLI. Right? And when you do imaging of the bone, typically you're like your plain radiograph, you're very likely going to see this moth-eating pattern, right? It's almost like some parasite has just been leeching off the bone, right? For a long time, right? So if you see a young kid having a bone malignancy and they have like almost like an infectious presentation, high fevers, severe joint pain, swelling, high white count, low hemoglobin, elevated ESR, CRP, LDH, you absolutely want to think about an Ewing sarcoma under those circumstances. And these people, again, they can have that onion skin pattern of the periosteum on imaging. That's something you want to commit to memory for exams. And one thing your friends at the MBME love to go after is they can give you a malignancy and ask, oh, what is the worst predictor of prognosis in this patient? It's actually the presence of mets. So when a person has mets in Ewing sarcoma, that usually portends like something really bad, right? The person has like an awful, awful, awful prognosis. If they don't have distant mets, the prognosis is not too bad. But if they have distant mets, it is not good at all. I'll tell you that right now. Now, one other thing you want to keep in mind, what if they give you a question about like a 70-year-old female and they tell you that she has been having like severe pain around her left wrist and they tell you that, oh, she has actually had like 2 fractures of that wrist over the last 3 years. And then they give you some labs, you notice that her creatinine is like 3.5. And they tell you that, you know, she's also been in and out of the hospital or she has required a lot of antibiotics in recent times for all these infection. If you see this, what should you be thinking about? I really hope you're telling me that this person has multiple myeloma, right? I really hope you're thinking of multiple myeloma. Remember, multiple myeloma on an MBME exam will present with CRAB symptoms, right? So those, what does the CRAB stand for, right? Like C-R-A-B, right? So the C stands for hypercalcemia, right? And what's the mechanism there? Remember, those multiple myeloma is a tumor of plasma cells. So those plasma cells, they can produce interleukin-1. Another name for interleukin-1 is osteoclast activating factor. That interleukin-1 can basically go and essentially leach away bone. I mean, literally another name for it, osteoclast activating factor, is going to activate osteoclasts, and that's going to leach away the person's bone, right? And that's going to cause hypercalcemia, right? And then the R stands for renal failure, right? Because again, remember, in multiple myeloma, those people can begin to develop amyloid in the kidneys, right? From those light chains. So that amyloid can damage the person's kidneys, right? And then the anemia. Why do these people get the anemia? Well, those plasma cells, they take over the entire bone marrow. So you have like ineffective hematopoiesis. You're not going to be able to make red blood cells. And again, if you're leaching away bone, you're going to have bone pain. So that's the crap. Hypercalcemia, renal failure, anemia, and bone pain. And the thing is, if a person is less than 40 years old on an NBM exam, please don't pick the answer that says multiple myeloma. It's almost like they give you a question about a female in her 60s and you're like, oh, she has MS. No. People in their 60s, can they get MS in the real world? Absolutely. But on NBM exams, no. That's not a thing, right? Usually the people that get MS on NBM exams, almost like 98% of the time, are females in their 30s. Females in their 30s, that's like the classic demographic for MS. Multiple myeloma is going to be an old person on an NBM exam. It's never going to be a person. Well, let me not say never, but you'd be hard-pressed, let me put that term, you'd be hard-pressed to find an NBME question where a person has multiple myeloma and they're less than 40 years old. Even in the real world, almost 90% plus of people that have multiple myeloma are over the age of 40, right? And again, don't forget your crab symptoms, right? So what are you going to do in terms of what's the classic finding on imaging for a person that has multiple myeloma? Again, don't forget, you'll find these punched out lytic lesions, and they're usually like pretty well circumscribed, right? Well demarcated, multiple punched out lytic lesions. That's the classic thing. And obviously, if you want to make the diagnosis, right, you're going to perform like an SPEP or a UPEP, right? So a serum protein electrophoresis or urine protein electrophoresis. And the thing is, multiple myeloma, they may try to trick you into doing surgery or whatever, or don't do any of those things. For the most part, multiple myeloma on NBM exams, you treat it with chemotherapy, right? And the chemotherapy sometimes, believe it or not, can be, there's this drug known as bortezomib. Bortezomib is a proteasome inhibitor, right, that can be used in the treatment of multiple myeloma. Also, some therapies for multiple myeloma include drugs like thalidomide, right? You may be like, oh, divine, thalidomide, are you kidding? Well, who are the people that are getting multiple myeloma? These are people that have no more reproductive potential, right? So they're not going to be having kids that have focomelia anytime soon, right? And then typically, they can ask you a question and say, which of the following interventions can be used to decrease the risk of pathologic fracture in this patient? You want to think about bisphosphonates, right? Bisphosphonates, whenever a person has a malignancy and it involves the bone, bisphosphonates are usually very good adjuncts to treatment so that they don't run into trouble. And then as I wrap up this podcast, right? So you want to know some things about mets to bone, right? So remember, the most common malignancies that can cause bone mets, right? It's going to be either prostate cancer in men or breast cancer in women, right? And despite what you see in many resources, most bone metastases tend to be osteolytic. Most bone mets tend to be lytic. The only ones that tend to be blastic are like prostate cancer. Prostate cancer is always going to be blastic on an NBM exam. And breast cancer in some cases can be blastic. But usually the most common kind of bone lesion associated with breast cancer, believe it or not, is a lytic bone lesion. And when a person has bone mets, or you suspect bone mets, the person's ALK force can be elevated. This is why seeing an ALK force elevation on an NBM exam does not always mean liver pathology. The only way that you can say, oh, ALK force on an NBM exam means that the person has like a biliary pathology, is if in addition to the ALK force being elevated, they have an elevation in GGT, right? Or they have an elevation in something called the 5' nucleotidase. Those are things that tell you, oh, okay, this person likely has bone mets on the exam. And again, if you want to evaluate the extent of a person's bone mets, or you suspect the person has bone mets, you want to go ahead and do a bone scan, right? This is something that's commonly done in radiology. Get a bone scan and you just see like hot spots everywhere, especially if it's a blastic lesion, right? Definitely read a ton of those studies for people that have a history of a prostate cancer, right? And then don't forget, bisphosphonates are the drugs you want to use, again, to decrease the risk of the person having like pathological fractures. The thing is, if a person has a lot of lesions in their spine, you can actually take them to like orthopedic surgery or like neurospine surgery, and then they will basically place like rods to stabilize those bones so that those things don't fracture and ultimately give rise to some kind of a paraplegia. Now, one high yield thing I want to say to conclude this podcast is, whenever a person is having orthopedic surgery on an NBM exam, is there something you're supposed to do before the surgery starts? I really hope you're saying, yes, divine. We want to give those people cefazolin, right? Remember, if you've done any surgery rotation, I feel like surgeons, they love ANSEF, right? ANSEF is like probably part of the surgery alphabet at this point, right? You're supposed to give that cefazolin about 30 to 60 minutes before the surgery starts, right? And obviously, if a person has like an allergy to like a penicillin of some sort, like ampicillin or whatever, you shouldn't give cefazolin, right? Remember, cefazolin is a first generation cephalosporin, right? So again, whenever a person is having orthopedic surgery, you always need to give some kind of pre-op antibody prophylaxis with cefazolin. That's the drug you want to give, right? And you basically give like an IV formulation pretty much for the most part, and the person should be fine. That actually decreases the risk that the person will develop infection. So let's go ahead and pause here for today. If you're interested, again, like I announced this morning, I have a step 2 CK course coming up on the 6th and the 7th of November from 11 a.m. Mountain Standard Time to 4 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. So it'll be 5 hours over 2 days. It'll be the 6th and 7th of November. If you're interested, just shoot me an email and I'll be happy to give you some more information. Basically, we're going to over 10 hours cover like 700, 800 concepts in like internal medicine, ped, surgery, OB-GYN, psych, neuro, right? Obviously, we're going to spend a lot of the time, probably like almost half the time on IM and neuro and surgery. Mostly IM for the most part, right? But again, we're going to cover all those subjects, cover all these fracture patterns, just a lot of things that the NBME cares about, especially with their more recent exams. We'll go over those during the course. And then the NBME test-taking strategies class, that's going to be taking place on the 5th of November. It's going to be taking place from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. Basically, Mountain Standard Time is 2 hours behind Eastern Time. And again, I'll have a bunch of NBME style questions that I'm going to use. I've taught test-taking strategies for years, right? So I'm pretty good at writing NBME questions. So I have a bunch of NBME style questions that I wrote that, again, reflect more not questions from like back in the day, but like the more recent questions, right? That look a lot like the questions from the new free 120, right? So we use those questions and I use a very systematic approach over a 2.5 hour period to go over principles behind test taking that should be very helpful for anyone taking step 2 CK or taking step 3. And, you know, please subscribe to the website. Remember, divineinterventionpodcast.com. And then we also have these podcasts on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on Google Play. So please subscribe. And then you can also subscribe to the YouTube channel. It's called Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. Now, one thing I want to share, I guess actually two things I want to share in terms of life lessons. So the first one just concerns the NRMP process. So we know that today was the deadline, right? Where people, not necessarily the deadline, but this is the day where you want to turn in your EHRAS application. Whether you have you don't have a score that has come in or a rec letter hasn't come in, doesn't matter. You always want to submit on the first day. That's always the smart, prudent thing to do, right? So the thing with that is, again, people become super anxious. Like, oh, am I going to get interviews? Am I going to get this? Am I going to get that? Just be calm. Be patient, right? Don't freak out. Because, again, I know that this is like a very, I've interacted, especially with my role reviewing applications, preparing people for like doing mock interviews with folks and stuff. I've seen the just heightened level of anxiety that's prevalent amongst med students with this time of the year. Just calm down, right? Again, if you have like a decent application, chances are you'll get a decent number of interviews. If you know you don't have the strongest scores known to man, or you're not very competitive for a discipline, you want to apply broadly, right? You want to apply to as many programs as you can. And if you have connections at programs, if you have people that can make calls for you, go ahead and have those people make those calls, right? In some cases, especially if it's a program that you have like some strong ties to, but you know you're not as competitive for that program, you can send a letter of interest. Again, notice I said, if you have like letters of intent are things you should probably send a little later in the process, but there's exceptions to that rule, right? If there's a program that you have very strong ties with or you have connections with, you can reach out to them even before they start sending out interview invites. So just one of those things you want to keep in mind. And obviously you want to do some mock interview practice, right? If you're interested in mock interview practice, I do mock interviews. Again, I've been on an admissions committee of a top 3 medical school, and I'm very familiar with the residency selection process for many disciplines. So if you want practice with mock interviews, again, just shoot me an email through the contact button on the website, and I'd be happy to guide you in the right direction. And then one other thing I would say with this whole match process is, again, with this cycle, with this Zoom cycle that we essentially have, it makes sense to apply to a decent number of programs, right? Even if you're a high scorer, right? Because normally, let's say you're applying to some specialties where, oh, with my score, I just need to apply to 20 programs. This year, apply to more than 20 programs because, again, there is very limited consequence to this cycle. You don't have to travel anywhere. You don't have to rent hotels or Airbnbs. You don't have to go for any applicant dinners, nothing. So even the high scorers will be applying to a ton of programs this year, right? So that, I just don't have time to explain my reasoning behind that. But basically, you don't want to put yourself in a tough situation or not get enough interviews or be shocked at where you end up ranking because you did not go on enough interviews, because you did not apply to enough programs in the first place, right? So you want to be somewhat liberal in your size. I'm not saying, oh, if normally you should apply to 20, you apply to 100. No, that's not what I'm saying. If you apply to 20, maybe apply to 35 or 40 this year, right? That's like a prudent thing to do. Obviously, cases vary by individual. Let's say you have like 270s on both your USMLE exams. You have like a ton of research, ton of everything. You can probably still get by with applying to like 20 programs, assuming, you know, you have like a good personality, good demeanor and stuff like that. So that's just something you want to keep in mind. And then the life lesson I want to share today, it's actually based on, so, you know, many of you that listen to this podcast, you know, I'm a Christian. There's a message I listened to by my pastor. That was actually yesterday. And this statement really stuck out to me. And I figured I'd just share with you guys and also just explain how it relates to our lives as medical professionals. And the statement was that things that have treasures behind them always have restricted entry. Right, I'll say that again. Things that have treasures behind them always have restricted entry. So one thing I would say is, if you want something good in life, if you want great things in life, you need to be willing to work hard for it. When you see people do so well on USMLE exams, and you marvel at the wonderful things they just did, or you see people, they are getting interviews left, right, and center, it's not because they have any kind of special ability. Those people just worked hard, right? They were willing to put in work that many people were not necessarily willing to put in. And I know some of you may be like, but Divine, I worked hard, but I still did not get the kind of scores I wanted. The thing is, the fact that you work hard does not mean you're going to succeed. It's one thing to work hard, but it's another thing to work hard in the right work, right? That's one thing that many med students kind of fall into. And that's, I'll say, probably like one of the things that brings people to me as, you know, they come to work with me as a tutor, is that you see people, they're doing all these things. They're spending 10 hours a day studying. But for their particular disposition as individuals, the way they're studying is not what will ultimately bring them success. Or the way they analyze questions or the way they take tests is not what will ultimately lead them to success. So that's something you need to be careful about. Don't just throw all your energies into something. Make sure it's something that will ultimately work well for your predisposition, right? So like, for example, like myself, I'm not a, Anki is just not the way I study. It just doesn't work for me that way. I study in very different ways. I mean, that's one of the reasons why you see me make a lot of podcasts and videos. I'm more of an audiovisual learner. I'm not a note taker. I really, really, really hate taking notes, right? I mean, I have really good handwriting, but I really hate taking notes. So the thing is, before you work hard, ask yourself, am I doing the right work, right? Work hard in the right work and you'll get success. But going back to my original point, if you want something good in life, right? If you want to match into Durham or if you want to do this or that, again, you can't, because believe it or not, I have actually met students that are just straight up lazy, right? Straight up lazy. Again, I know you may think that, oh, everyone that is in medicine is hardworking. That's not true. I'm telling you, the reason why some people fail exams is just because they're just lazy. They are not willing to put in the work. They're not willing to be thorough in their prep. They just want to get by, right? But the thing is, that get by spirit would, obviously, if you get by, like there are many, if you get by, you will get opportunities that most people get, right? But if you want to be the elite of the elite, if you want to do really well, if you want to get those opportunities that not everyone gets, You need to work by means of restricted entry. What do I mean by restricted entry? It means you need to make sacrifices. Again, there's nothing good that comes in life without you making sacrifices, right? Things that are genuinely good, you need to make sacrifices for those things, right? I mean, like, there's even this part of the Bible that says that you should enter by the narrow gate, right? Because narrow is the way that leads to life, and there are few that take it, right? But broad is the way that leads to darkness, and there are many that take that route, right? So the thing is, broad, something that is broad, right, doesn't you can easily walk through that thing without any restrictions, right? But, you know, if you want to, like, for example, the Lakers, right, they won the championship. And again, in case you've not noticed, I'm a LeBron fan at this point. The Lakers, they won that championship because they went through an adverse process. They did many things that people are not willing to do, right? LeBron has a great body because he does many things that people are not willing to do. So what are those goals you have in your life that you're like, man, I really want to accomplish this thing. I want to be the head in this particular area of life. Make those sacrifices, right? There's no glory without a story behind it. Whenever you see a message and it says, oh, I got a 270 and I just studied for a week and did this and did that, they're pretty much lying to you. They're just trying to project this false sense of humility. Usually those people have worked really hard for a long enough period of time to get those kinds of results, right? So again, there is no glory without a story behind it. So just be mindful of that. So thank you for listening. I will see you in the next podcast. God bless you and have a wonderful evening. Thank you.